Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now on with Monkey Tennis.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring!
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yep, absolutely. Yep, 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 absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk. Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the host house.
Keep it down, love.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
It's got more peas than a pensioner's pamper.
Nick Holder.
I'm a married woman, I'll have you know.
And Tom Stab.
Your teas are a bit splashy.
So, the reason for today's special intro quotes and the fact that we're not bringing you Oast House episodes this week is that we've had the second in our series of two very special guests this series. So, for those of you who enjoyed our insight into the world of Psychic Simon with Tim Key, you will hopefully be delighted to know that this week is an interview with Jenny Gresham herself, Susanna Fielding. So, let's talk to Tom and Nick, who carried out said interview. What did you learn? What are we in for this week?
Oh, well, it was a fantastic chat. Again, kind of, Susanna was so generous with her time. Really happy to talk about everything in the APU. I think what's definitely worth flagging is we get some quite exciting insight into this time series too. So we've got some potentially exclusive information on that coming up in this interview.
Yeah, it was really nice to hear a different perspective from a relative newcomer to the APU. So it was great to just hear Susanna's kind of perspective on her relationship with Alan and, yeah, the exciting news of this time series two, which I know we're kind of all looking forward to. And there was just loads of kind of tidbits generally throughout the chat. So it was a fantastic opportunity to speak to her, and it was a really great chat.
That's great. So, yeah, those of you who are used to hearing us come from the Oast House, we'll be reviewing those episodes again from next week. But for now, let's head over to past Nick, past Tom and past Susanna Fielding.
Dear listeners, we are joined today by an actor of both stage and screen. You may have seen her in Black Mirror, Sticks and Stones, Pete vs. Life, Catastrophe, Drifters, or perhaps treading the boards at the Donmar, the Young Vic, or the National Theatre. Most recently, she's featured in the YouTube comedy series depicting lockdown life Housebound, and right now she's part of the ensemble cast for BBC One's six-part drama Life. Last but most certainly not least, you'll know her as the formidable Partridge foil Jenny Gresham, co-host of This Time with Alan Partridge, having cemented herself as an integral part of the APU. Today we welcome Susanna Fielding to Monkey Tennis. Hello, Susanna.
Hello. Hi. What a nice intro. Thanks.
I just thought the one thing we didn't explain, when we refer to the APU, that's our abbreviation for the Alan Partridge Universe.
It
might be a useful thing for
is.
You to know if we use that term. Of course.
Thank you very much. Technical terms. Okay.
So, Susanna, to begin with, it would seem remiss to not acknowledge the backdrop of coronavirus that is affecting pretty much everything right now. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's a shame to not be in an actual studio with such fantastic guests, but if a chat over Zoom is the only way we can do this, then we'll gladly take it. So thank you so much for joining us and taking some time to chat all things Alan. But to start with, we want to do a bit of a general check-in. How are you doing? How have the last 6 months been for you? Are doing conversations like this over Zoom an accurate representation of your new normal?
They appear to be, yes. I'm very much missing human contact, but this is it's a close second. I get to see you all in your natural habitat as well. We're on Zoom, so I can see Tom's backdrop, which has got some interesting things on the shelf. And you get to see a bit of mine. But yeah, it's been challenging. I've luckily been doing voiceovers in my wardrobe with a duvet over my head and things like that to keep myself going. And doing this YouTube thing, Housebound, which has been really fun, written by some brilliant writers who wrote a thing called I Want My Wife Back that I did a while ago. So I've been surviving, and thankfully the weather's been amazing, hasn't it? So I've been getting into gardening. I've basically entered retirement, guys. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too bad. I mean, we've been able to fill some of our lockdown time diving into Alan's new podcast From the Oast House. We're wondering, this might be a bit too much of a busman's holiday for you, but have you listened to any of that yet? Will you be checking it out?
You know what? I was listening to your last episode of Monkey Tennis.
Uh-oh. Oh, God.
So, oh, no. Yeah. Sorry, guys. I'm on to you. It really did sort of pique my interest. So I think I will be listening to it. Absolutely. And it's come at a really good time, hasn't it? With everyone kind of desperate for some new content and new material. So, it couldn't be better, really.
I definitely wouldn't recommend listening to us before you listen to that. You've probably...
Okay, because we will ruin it for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'll do it that way around
just,
then.
Just to be honest about it. Coronavirus obviously had a huge impact on performing arts and the film and the TV industry. Has there been much impact for you personally in terms of, did you have any work lined up for 2020 that hasn't been able to take place?
Yeah, I did. I was supposed to be filming a new thing, which the writers of Alan Partridge have written. And that's been put on hold until next year. And apart from that, I was potentially doing something in the Cotswolds as well, which has been put on hold. So it has been a really tricky time for everybody. There's no denying that. And obviously theatre is looking like it's a way off before we get to do anything like that. Yeah. But the good news is that we've brought forward the filming of This Time too. So we are going to be starting shooting that in a few weeks. So there's some plus points in that, and it's meant that all the writers have had the time, which they might not have done, to sit down and really crack on with that, Steve included, obviously. There's a silver lining to all of this, but yeah, I consider myself quite lucky. I seem to have come out fairly unscathed so far.
Doing the voiceover work in the cupboard with the duvet has kept you busy.
Exactly, it's all glamour.
Oh, well, I'm sure we'll probably get onto This Time in a bit, because I'm sure we'd want to delve a bit more into potentially series two, whether you can even say anything about that yet. So, let's see.
Yeah, we've got quite a lot of obviously Alan Partridge focused questions, but we wondered kind of almost before we delve into that, kind of growing up, what was your relationship with comedy like? What were the shows that, you know, you kind of grew up with? What kind of comedy inspired you as you were kind of growing up? And is comedy something you always wanted to get into as an actor?
Yeah, it really is. It's always been something that I've been perhaps slightly different to my peers in like, I'm just simply not interested in Hollywood or Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or being in a Marvel film. Like, it just doesn't interest me. My obsession has always been British comedy since I was tiny. My idea of a fun Saturday afternoon is watching reruns of 40 Towers on VHS for the afternoon, or The British Empire, or Last of the Summer Wine, or Ab Fab. Like, all of those shows were kind of, and they still are really, what kind of makes me tick. So I consider myself very fortunate that I've been able to make a career in something that I just find, I just think it's something we do so well and so differently to everywhere else. It seems British comedy is, that's my drug. So yeah, that was what I was into.
I really love those like nuggets as well with, you know, things like 40 Towers are played kind of ad nauseum on TV, but things like the British Empire where you kind of think, I love that growing up, but you can't really find it now, but it was still great. And, you know, those kind of like buried treasures, things like the Thin Blue Line and these kind of things that you just don't see very much anymore. But yeah. No, I think we're all big fans of those shows.
Excellent. We're all on the same page.
And then in terms of, I guess, Alan Partridge as a kind of character, what was your kind of first experience? Because the character's been going for such a long time. There's so many different entry points that you kind of come into. What was the point at which you kind of became just a fan or aware or started watching that character?
I think I sort of like, I didn't have any brothers or anything. And I think it was sort of quite a sort of like male thing, perhaps initially. Mm. Like lots of the fans that I know are men in their mid to late 30s or early 30s, gentlemen.
I'll take that.
Don't assume. I just say don't assume.
So I think I maybe sort of didn't get on board with it until I was a little bit older. And then my first intro was I'm Alan Partridge. And then I watched some of the Knowing Me, Knowing You and loved that. But actually, it was only really when I started auditioning for the show that I kind of did the deep dive and started kind of reading stuff and watching Mid Morning Matters. I loved Alpha Papa. I had seen that already. And I think that's a really great film. Absolutely loved it. But there's still so much more to kind of explore. It feels endless. Like, this is why you're on episode 100, right?
It's like... Yeah, we know it's endless.
Especially when you go into as much detail as you guys do. Like, we can go around again. But I think that is just a testament to the writing, ultimately, isn't it? Is the detail is extraordinary. And that's why, you know, making a show that, you know, like this time or whatever takes so long, because they're constantly rewriting and shooting again if it's not right and finding more and more bits of detail to add in, which obviously the mega fans absolutely love, but it's what makes it such a quality show, I think.
Was there in watching earlier Alan, so kind of all the pre this time Alan, was there anything, any kind of really standout moments? So you mentioned, for example, that you loved Alpha Papa, but was there anything that really stuck with you when you were kind of delving into all of the output?
That's a good question, actually.
So I think everybody tends to have their favourite kind of era of Alan or favourite Alan show. So whether that's I'm Alan Partridge or Mid-Morning Matters and whatever, it's kind of interesting how everyone has these different favourites, I think.
Well, I loved Knowing Me, Knowing You, because it felt like it was sort of kind of a first, and I've heard lots of people saying that they watched it and really thought it was a TV show, like they really thought it was a chat show. So I always love that sort of thing where you're kind of, you know, some people aren't quite aware of what's going on and there's a show within a show, which of course is, you know, what's brilliant about this time. They've sort of reinvented that, and I loved how big the characters were and how kind and the sort of sort of staginess of it as well, like it's quite theatrical.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. But then I also absolutely love the kind of throwaway of Mid-Morning Matters as well, and how kind of compressed that is with those two just sat in a room. So I can see elements of all of it that I love, really. But yeah.
It's probably time to move on to this time, because we've got so much we want to talk to you about when it comes to that show. We heard that you got the part of Jenny by sending in a self-taped audition whilst you were living in LA. I believe that's correct. So could you tell us a bit about the process of auditioning for the role and how that all played out?
Yeah, so basically I got sent some scenes from my agent and was immediately like, oh, okay, this is seriously good, because she's, you know, she's not just a kind of foil to him. And the scenes that they sent me were the opening scenes from the very first episode, where she comes in and she says, I'm sorry, I'm late. And she sort of sits down next to him and she's practicing what she's going to say. And then he makes a joke and she steals it. And so that whole scene, it very quickly became clear that it was dealing with a character that kind of had an edge to her, and there was that she was going to be kind of driving some of the comedy as well. And so that was obviously very exciting. And then I can't remember what other scenes. Oh, and there was another scene where I had to do the articulation bit where I'm sort of teaching him to say, oh, goodness, I've forgotten the word.
Enunciating about the, yeah, exactly. About the splashy T's.
Exactly, yeah. The splashy T's. Yeah. Yeah, you see just a little bit splashy there, yeah.
bit sibilant.
Yeah, so that is exactly, a bit sibilant,
that's it,
exactly.
That's it, yeah.
It's been a while, it's been...
I can't think what the word is, though.
No, what is it? It's something a bit sexual, isn't it? Something a bit flirty, and you can sort of see him really struggling with the whole thing. Yeah. So I make him look at my mouth. I can't really remember what it is now. It's been a while. Anyway, it will come to us.
Yeah, it will come to us, yeah.
So they sent me those two scenes, and I decided to kind of, like, really go for it. So I dressed up looking as, you know, daytime TV as I could. And I had a friend help me film it, and he sat next to me and did his very best Alan Partridge impression, which kind of weirdly does help because it's all about the timing, isn't it? And the responses to his ridiculousness. And then sent that tape off and got a call quite soon after saying that it was down to me and one other person. And would I fly back to London to meet Steve and the writers, Rob and Neil Gibbons, for an hour and a half's improv audition? I was like, oh, my God.
No pressure.
No pressure whatsoever. Just down to you and one other person. I remember being extremely nervous about... I think it was probably the most nervous I've ever been, probably. Mainly because you're not hanging on to lines. It's all about what happens between you and Steve Coogan. So it's either going to go well or it's not. so we met in the Soho Theatre in London and then went up into a small room and just kind of worked on their relationship really for about an hour and a half and had a really good time doing it. And Steve is an amazing actor, as I'm sure you guys agree. He's not just an incredible comic, but actually it's about the scene and it's about what's going on between the two characters as much as him trying to be funny. So that kind of actually just took the pressure off massively. And then that went well. And then a few days later, they called and said, can you film some more scenes? And I'm thinking, oh, God, is this good news or bad news? And I did send some more scenes in. And then I think maybe two or three days after that, I was coming up out of Leicester Square Tube Station and got a call from my agent saying it's yours. And I jumped up and down and started yelling in the street. I think because I'd been on such a journey with it. It's obviously an amazing gig, but also I'd been, you know, I'd become quite attached to the character and the idea of doing it by that stage. So, yeah, it was super exciting.
So how that's actually really good kind of almost like leading to the next point then about... Curious as to how much kind of development you could have into that character, because as you say, so much of it is like, yes, you've got what's on the script, but it's kind of how you can kind of build out that character. So were you able in those sessions with Steve to kind of almost like build out the characterization of Jenny and kind of make it your own in a sense?
Yeah, I think they'd sort of done the beginning foundations, and I think they was perhaps, you know, looking for someone to come in and bring more to the picture, which is obviously the fun bit as an actor. So I think we really developed that sense of tension between them, whether there was any kind of like sexual chemistry or whether she was just absolutely, you know, infuriated by him from the beginning, and then sort of adding in that vulnerability about the fact that perhaps her marriage wasn't going very well or she was in fact separated. And you know, how competitive and ambitious she is. So we kind of started to build all of that into it and what her backstory would be as well. So, yeah, I mean, they're really collaborative. And we also had rehearsals, which you often don't get for TV. So we spent a few days in a room just kind of workshopping, you know, what that might be. So, yeah, it was super creative, actually. And I think there'll be more to come of that. We'll see a bit more of that backstory.
And would you, like, when you're rehearsing kind of or getting into a part, obviously you'd be doing lots of kind of research. Is there any merit in watching, you know, Good Morning Britain or The One Show? Or, like, would you have to kind of watch those things and understand the dynamic of the kind of, you know, working with a co-host? And was that helpful?
It was super helpful. I mean, obviously I watched loads of Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan, Alex Jones on The One Show, Tess Daly, who else? That sort of style of presenting, you had to get it absolutely right. Just like they've got the filming of the show absolutely spot on, the style of the sofa, the cutaways, you know, the performances had to be kind of on point for that to work, I think. And then I went to watch the one show as well, because obviously what you really need to then understand is what happens when they cut and it goes to a VT, and what do the presenters actually do when the cameras aren't rolling on them. And that was really fascinating, because they are so unbelievably slick that they sort of got a banana behind the, you know, behind the sofa or a cup of coffee, or they immediately get their phone out and, you know, they're so on off. So I obviously really wanted to bring as much of that in, the kind of that Jenny's such a pro that she's kind of, she's working on six different things all at once.
It's kind of that idea of, like, you know, you're smiling while the camera's on, and then it's like, and cut, and then it's like face drops, pick up phone, check Twitter, or you're into the next scene or whatever it is. It's
they are so unbelievably good at that. So yeah, I think that's quite accurate.
It's just turning it off and on like a switch, isn't it? It's literally that process. We were going to ask you, actually, because we kind of see a side to Jenny that is, that definitely appears quite ruthless at times. Do you think that's a fair assessment, or is she just giving as good as she gets with Alan? What's your take on her relationship with Alan?
I think she is incredibly ambitious, and I think to get to the point that she's got to in the industry she's got to at the time she's got to, so let's say it's 2018, 2019, I think you probably had to be pretty ambitious and quite maybe a bit hard-nosed to kind of rise up the ladder as quickly as she has. And I think she's absolutely kind of disbelieving of how useless he is. She's obviously very disappointed, and I think was quite close with John before... Sadly, his illness changed things.
He will be missed.
He will be missed. John gone. Hashtag John gone.
Never fails to make me laugh, that.
I know, it's so good, isn't it? So, yeah, I think she is deeply frustrated with him. But I think she also is perhaps one of these women that quite likes to be adored as well. And so she's sort of playing on that as well. She can obviously tell that he's perhaps a bit flummoxed by her. And so she enjoys the sort of power play there. But I think we're hopefully going to be able to develop that further.
Well, I was going to say, it definitely feels like there's an ebb and a flow across the series of their relationship, where you think at some points they're getting on, and then there are moments of this conflict, and there's almost like a weird kind of control that she has over him in a way, in terms of how she utilises his reactions and emotions. So, yeah, do you think there may be scope to develop that more into the next series? Or is that what you'd be hoping for? Yeah,
I think so, definitely. Yeah, I think it's almost like we've been laying the groundwork for which direction it's going to go in. And I think that we wanted a sense of ambiguity around them. It wasn't clear that just like, oh, Jenny hates Alan, end of story. That's a lot less
interesting.
That simple. It's not that simple, no. There's sort of part of her that's sort of quite curious about him, I think. And he does sort of make her laugh as well. And there's a sort of, she also perhaps feels a little bit sorry for him. And she's also a bit vulnerable. And he can be weirdly sort of quite kind sometimes. So I suppose it's like all the relationships, you know, throughout the various series, they're never just completely clean cut, which is what makes them all so interesting, isn't it? And stand the test of time.
I think one of the things that we've always been curious about is just the character of Alan and how it's so versatile and how it's endured for so long. So it's been across so many mediums. So whether it's TV, whether it's film, whether it's books, and now kind of in a podcast. And do you have any view on kind of why the character is so versatile? Because even, you know, much loved comedy characters like, you know, Basil Fawlty or Derek Trotter or whatever it might be, like, they haven't existed outside of TV, even though they've been hugely popular. What is it about Alan Partridge that seems to work across all of these different mediums?
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Well, I mean, I think it's firstly the fact that he's managed to kind of morph and update, which is really extraordinary. Mm. So he's managed to make him relevant or irrelevant, as the case may be, at each point. But also, I think we do all know someone a bit like him. And we've all almost always, like, all been him at some point as well. With some of the, one of the things I follow on Twitter is, like, the Alan Partridge, like, one where people say things that are, like, Alan Partridge quotes.
Yeah.
And they're everywhere, aren't they? We know politicians or people at work or, you know, an uncle or whatever who are like him. And so I think maybe it's got something to do with that, that that is sort of timeless, his sort of inappropriateness. And but I also just think the writing has just kind of been developed and enhanced at each point. Like Rob and Neil are just incredible, the amount of material that they produce, and it's all such top quality stuff, isn't it? So maybe it's that, I don't know. It's an extraordinary achievement, isn't it?
It is. And I think you're right. I think the Gibbons have had a huge hand in not only kind of reviving the character, but being able to adapt it so cleverly. And you're right, their writing style is so on point, and the output is so consistently strong. It would love to hear more about kind of working with the Gibbons in terms of their writing style. And we've always heard kind of stories about whether it's Alpha Papa or whether it's this time that the writing is so up to the wire. It must be a really unique kind of situation to be in as an actor. But how do you find that? How do you operate in that kind of environment?
I had a drink with Tim Key last night, actually, and we were talking about it and saying that we were very, very lucky because we both had auto cue. So we obviously we didn't get a script the night before, or we had one, but we knew it would change. We'd get another one in the car in the morning at sort of 5:30, meaning that those guys have been doing something between 10 p.m. and 5:30 in the morning.
Oh my God.
God only knows. And then in the makeup chair, you'd get another version of the script, but you don't want to learn that either. And then on set, you'd start reading through kind of what we were up to at that point. You know, sat on the sofa in the morning at sort of 6 a.m. And then it would change again, and we'd poke things out, take things out, poke new bits in, change jokes, and then we'd probably shoot something. But because we had everything on our auto cue, it meant that we could kind of work that quickly. And but for the guests coming in, I think it was a lot harder because they obviously had to appear like they knew exactly what they were saying and they weren't being fed it by anybody. And Tim, as he was saying last night, had an even easier job because he's supposed to look completely baffled, like he doesn't know what the hell's going on. so he really mastered that brilliantly.
Yeah.
He really does, doesn't he? It's extraordinary. So obviously I'm a consummate professional. So as long as I knew which camera I was supposed to be looking at on each bit, I genuinely am sight reading new text for the first time on quite a lot of what you ended up seeing on the TV. So it's unlike anything else. But I have to say, like, I wouldn't swap it for the world, because it's about getting things as funny as they can be. And that means tweaking and tweaking and tweaking right up until the last minute. That's what I'm interested in. So I'd rather have a stressful kind of few weeks of comedy boot camp than a safe script that we're just doing because that's what they wrote in their bedrooms 6 months before.
So it wasn't a case that things were improvised then, but it's a case that things were changed right up to the last minute.
Yeah, yeah. Like every kind of and ah and word ends up in a script, which is set. But we would kind of play around with how that ends up being, and then it would get put into a script and be set, and then we'd keep going and keep going. And obviously Steve might add in the odd few bits that weren't expected, but generally the framework's pretty solid.
Basically, Steve's the only one who's allowed to improvise. That's pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you could say that. But yeah, most of it is kind of pre-agreed. Yeah.
It's quite interesting, the process of you having the auto cue, because that means in effect you're doing exactly the real job of being a one show presenter. That's exactly how those shows work, which is probably quite unusual for a comedy show, I would imagine. Probably a first.
Yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, it's really made me massively appreciate what they do. They've got someone in their ear, they've got paperwork, they've got a screen below them, and they've got an auto cue, and they've got the guest on the sofa with them. So there's so many variables of things that could change, and they have to make it look like they're sort of, paddling ducks, like everything's normal and expected. Massive props to anybody that can do that. It's very exciting though. It is exciting. And it's certainly not something that I've ever done before in conjunction with comedy, but it's all about timing really, isn't it? So as long as you've set the timing of everything, with Lolly coming in and doing her not being able to hear him, that sort of thing, as long as that's really set, I think it works brilliantly, doesn't it, together.
I think when we went through our analysis of the show, a lot of our favorite moments were probably those things where it came down to the perfect timing. So things like the shuttlecock falling down, or when he's got cocksucker written on the clipboard and you slap it down, all those kind of quite kind of slapstick, but perfectly timed as well. But I think those were some of our standouts. And we were going to ask actually for you, do you have, when you look back, do you have a favorite episode from that whole series? And do you have any particular favorite moments that really stick out for you?
I think one of my all-time favourite moments is the first time that we meet the Digiwall and Tim can't work it out. I honestly think that is one of the best comedic set pieces.
Yeah.
The timing of that, not that one, not, where he's that little process.
Yeah.
And that was very specifically timed and choreographed. And I think it took them quite a long time to get it exactly how they wanted it, and it's worth it. I like the detail of the fact that they designed the steps on the This Time set so that it would be like a step and a half rather than a comfortable step.
Yeah.
I just love that. And so that moment of him going up the steps the first time, I really like the bit where he comes in the car with the with the dancers from the Richmond
with the fizzed up squealers. I think that's what he calls them.
Yeah.
Does he?
Yeah.
And what does he say, we've been rehearsing in Richmond Town Hall or something? No, it's something even more kind of banal than that, isn't it? It's brilliant. Can you remember what it is?
I can't remember what it is, but one of them is definitely a shaved boy. I remember that much.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the kind of really ambiguous, bye, Alan. Bye. It's just genius. And then I suppose all the brilliant stuff about women and him trying to understand, the Me Too movement and women's rights and stuff. I just think it's really, really well played, isn't it?
He tries his best.
He tries his best. And I think that's another thing why people still really like him, is that he is he's sort of awful, but he is trying his best. And I don't think he's really a bad person. I don't know what you guys think.
We've talked about it for about probably how many episodes of it? 100 hours? Just the 100 hours of analysis. But he's on the right side of wrong, effectively. And he is doing he is doing his best, and he's keen to understand these complicated issues. But it's just his articulation and his understanding and his personality that fails him to kind of really kind of properly grapple with them, which does kind of beg the question how he got the BBC, job in the first place. But that's a bigger question. How did you find being on set with all of the kind of, wealth of talent that was there? Just in terms of even things corpsing, is there kind of pressure to kind of keep it together because you don't want to be kind of the one that's, having to, the scene having to be kind of cut? How does that work in terms of just keeping it together on set because what you're seeing is so funny?
I mean, I think you get quite good at that it's sort of practice of being able to hold it together and then a cut kind of release. But we definitely did have quite a few things. I think the toilet thing where he was trying to hands-free ablutions in the train carriage, I think that was one of the hardest ones. And I think the first time that his lips were revealed, I think he didn't show us before. And so that was quite a tricky one. But you kind of get good at that. But also, you know, one of the great things about doing this job is that you are sort of paid to laugh, really. Like you often do have a real laugh and you stop and kind of enjoy the moment. And then once you've got it out of your systems, then you all know you can kind of carry on. Mm. But yeah, I've never been told off for it so far, but there's still time.
Yeah, no, of course. Is it kind of like a fairly chaotic kind of day then, in terms of what that day looks like, in terms of the timings, the length of it, what's going on? Everyone's kind of moving very frantically. It's just the pace of the day from beginning to end is pretty relentless.
Is manic, yeah. And especially for Rob and Neil and Steve, because if we're on a lunch break or a tea break, they're writing. And the boys are behind the monitors with their laptops writing for the next episode whilst directing and filming what we're doing at that time. So, which is nice because you get quite a lot of creative freedom. Every sort of couple of weeks, I'd be like, everything all right, lads? And they'd be like, yeah, all good, carry on. So it was, yeah, it is unlike any other kind of set I've been on. And often you're changing the order of things because they want to write something better for a certain scene, so they're not ready to shoot that yet or whatever. But I suppose the slightly easier thing is that most of it's on the one location on set. Mm. So you're not kind of doing lots of moves and stuff as well. But we had an amazing first AD who managed to steer the ship with, I literally have no idea how she did it. We didn't even know who was going to be in it at certain points, and somehow a schedule was created. So yeah, hats off.
I think we would all agree that Jenny absolutely made this time what it was. She, the perfect foil to Alan, essentially seeing the show. And I think we also agreed that when Tim Key joined the APU as Psychic Simon, he stole the show in Mid-Morning Matters as well. So for your point of view, how did it feel to be joining such a well-established and long-running comedic franchise? So, you know, at this point, there were, over 25 years of Alan on our screen. So the pressure must have felt quite immense.
Yeah, it was huge, to be honest. Yeah, and of course you film something, but you don't ever really get to see what's been filmed. Like, you don't watch back, really. Maybe very occasionally I'd have a little sneak behind the monitors. Right. So it was only until a year later when they'd finished doing the edit. It took that long for various reasons. We did some reshoots and stuff, but actually I just think they wanted to get the look of it exactly right, so it was worth taking that time. But it was a year of me going, am I in it? Is it just my shoulder? Like, you know, you just don't know.
Right.
It was only when they did this big screening at the BBC, which was just before the release, that I was like, okay, I'm definitely in it. And I think it's good, but really it's about how people respond. And with a show like this, when the fans are so invested, it's about the response from those people. So I have to say, like, I'm not massive on social media, but I was sort of slightly terrified that I was going to get, you know, barrages of complaints that I'd ruined everyone's fun. 25 years of fun I had personally ruined.
Unfortunately, that very much wasn't the case.
No, thank God, yeah.
I mean, like you say, the media interest in the show was huge. Like, you even got the chance to co-host BBC News for a few minutes on launch day, for example. So
yeah.
What did that feel like in comparison to any other shows that you've worked on? I guess it was kind of like nothing else.
It was like nothing else. And nowadays it's so rare that a release date of a TV show is a thing, right? Like that everyone's going to sit down on that Tuesday night and watch it at 8 o'clock or whenever it was on. I think it's 9. This sort of like collective, you know, intake of breath before watching the show, and that everyone's going to watch it on that night. That's just not really how people watch television anymore. So that was really kind of extraordinary. And the sort of build up to it was kind of crazy, to be honest. Yeah, we were doing interviews everywhere and, you know, it was on BBC Breakfast and doing, you know, lots and lots of radio interviews and press and stuff for newspapers and things as well. So the interest was kind of amazing and overwhelming. And so thank God it was all positive when the show did come out.
Well, I guess I thinking about it, it's actually quite unusual the fact that the BBC even had a screening. Mm-hmm. So we were actually lucky enough to be invited to that as well, because friends in high places, can't reveal our sources. And yeah, for the BBC to have a screening of two episodes of a new sitcom, I guess that never happens, does it? That's so unusual, right?
I guess not. And the people at that screening, I mean, Monty Don, for one, well, he was quite. There.
Dante. Dante.
Monty. Oh, yeah. He was there. And the great and the good of British comedy, really. So
and
it
the
was
bad.
Kind.
That's our bit. Yeah.
That's us you. Covered. Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone had to clear away the plates and glasses.
Thanks for that, guys. I meant to say. Yeah, it was kind of mad. Like, Ben Elton was there and. Everyone who was, you know, the Fleabag cast were there.
Yeah.
All sorts of incredible people.
I do remember, I think we were stood in a corner eating cheese straws going, oh my God, it's that person. Oh my God, they're here. I mean, I can't even remember the list, but it was, like you say, it was the entire kind of British comedy establishment was out in force for it, I think, which is quite incredible.
Unusual, because I don't know, normally certain shows pique certain people's interest, right? And you're going for a certain kind of portion of society, but I don't know, this seems to really kind of go much, much wider than that, and it's also got a massive sort of new young teenage following, as far as I'm aware, as well, of like younger people who hadn't really known it before.
I think it was the kind of significance within the kind of, you know, the Alan Partridge, you know, universe, in terms of him coming back to the BBC within Alan's world is huge. And actually, you know, Alan has passed from, you know, it's Audible, it's been on Sky, he's also kind of transitioned not just multiple media platforms, but different kind of media companies. So it was the significance of Alan coming back to the BBC, and also within Alan's world coming back to the BBC, that I think just really heightened just the interest in this, and to be back on prime time and all of those things just contributed to a huge amount of interest in the character's kind of return. So we're left on, I guess, a bit of a cliffhanger in series one as to, you know, what's kind of going on. I mean, obviously, you know, is there anything you can kind of share, or in terms of what that future could potentially look like?
Well, it was sort of left, you know, it kind of open, wasn't it, at the end of the first series as to like whether I would come back, whether he would get fired, whether I would leave. There was a real sense of like, ooh, you know, are we even going to get another series of this? And if so, is it going to be the same setup as what we've had before? So I can confirm that I'm in it. So that's good. and I'm in a lot of it. So I think it's going to be, I imagine, somewhat COVID related, but I don't know, just because obviously that's what's going on in the world at the moment, and that affects kind of everything. And I do know that we're going to kind of get a bit more in depth with their relationship, the two of them. And I mean, there's so much material. I feel like you could make like 10 series of this time, couldn't you, and not run out of material, because you know, the way it's set up is sort of a wealth of stuff that they could use. But apart from that, rehearsals are supposed to start in a couple of weeks. So, it's all big question marks at the moment.
Exciting. Yeah. I think that we kind of fans and, you know, anyone that enjoys it, that the Gims have really built up credibility as well within the fan base, that you just know that the writing is going to be really strong, because they haven't really let anyone down since they took the kind of helm. So I think they'll find a really interesting perspective on what Alan and this time means really in this new kind of world, and I think we all kind of have faith that they'll find an interesting perspective on how to approach that, because it's such an interesting opportunity with COVID that I think they'll really kind of find something interesting to latch onto.
I'm very hopeful as well. Yeah, I think it'll be wonderful for us all to be able to watch it from that framework, through that perspective. I think it's probably what we all need, isn't it?
Yeah, light relief.
Yes, please, God.
And if rehearsals are starting relatively soon, how does that work in terms of the process of getting an initial script, which, you know, will change 20 times before you get to filming? Like, when will you first see any of the words that are going to be this time series two? When will that happen?
That's
or has that happened?
That's a jolly good question, Tom.
You'd like to know.
I'd really love to know if you could find out. No, we're chasing on scripts at the moment, but as obviously was the case with the last series, I'm sure there'll be lots of different reincarnations before. But I think there'll be a general sort of sense, like there was last time, of what the journey is, and what the ending is. Although we did shoot a number of different endings for last series, so it's only when I watched it on the telly that I knew which one it would be.
Oh wow, that's really interesting. Yeah. I think that's, is that an exclusive? I wasn't aware of that. It's an exclusive for us, I think.
It's an exclusive. Yeah, I mean, there was definitely an episode 6 where I stayed a lot longer. And there was some more explosive argument as well. And so they went with, I think, the right option, which was a sort of what's going to happen next.
A lot of ambiguity to it.
Yeah.
And what, so they deliberately didn't tell you what they were going to choose until it basically went to the final edit?
I think they just like to give themselves options once they see the whole show together as to like what feels right. So I think it was more about that rather than them trying to drive me crazy.
So I was going to ask, when you talk about the kind of constant rewriting process, does that mean that from the outset, though, do you have a kind of roadmap of broadly what the plot points are going to be? So you have a rough idea of where the story is going to go, but it's the wording that changes and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's more the timing or the joke, or maybe a bit of speech will be passed from Alan to me or me to Alan, and we'll cut up certain bits so that there's, you know, in those moments where we step on each other, for example, we'll rehearse that and make sure that we're, you know, we're both saying the first three lines together, and then it goes on to me and then back to him. So it's sort of apportionment of lines. And then sometimes the subject will change. So like if they're just thinking that something isn't funny enough, like the content isn't funny enough, they'll just go and write something else.
But it's interesting that they can be literally the morning of shooting going, this still isn't good enough, basically.
Yeah. And we shot a whole scene as well that got, I think nearly a whole episode that got reshot as well, because it wasn't funny enough.
Because I think...
Or they just didn't feel it fitted, yeah.
Because I think, was there something around, I think, did the order of the episodes change or something like that as well?
Yes, I think they did, yeah. So that was another thing that's complicated when we were filming it, because I'm going, hang on, sorry, do I know that? Have we done that bit? Or do I not know that yet? We don't know yet. and also, like, I wanted her kind of look to progress as well, and so with costume and things like that, and their kind of physical proximity, that did add some complication, but obviously again they got it right in the end. You just trust them.
Yeah. And it's interesting thinking about, so were there many other things that didn't make it to final edits? Because I think when we look back to older things like I'm Alan Partridge, you used to always get the kind of DVDs with the kind of 10 minutes of extra scenes and bloopers and things like that. Is there much on the cutting room floor from this time, or did most of it actually come to air?
No, I think there must be lots, actually. Like, I mean, for starters, I did loads of like VTs, you know, how he goes out and does his interviews and stuff. So I did quite a few of those, which are playing in the background sometimes. You can see them on the screens. And then we might cut away, but it's playing, like we filmed the whole thing. So there's quite a lot of that didn't make the edit. And there's a bit where I go to a farm, I think. I don't know if that ended up in it. And another bit where I'm doing like jogging in the background. all sorts of ridiculous stuff. And then there was a kind of like quiz bit that they did, which didn't end up in it. So yeah, quite a bit.
Oh, I think, did Rob and Neil talk about there was some kind of moral maze type segment that didn't come to fruition? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because we thought this was interesting. We got, when it came out on DVD, there was only the one extra scene, which I think was, I guess, one of the early rehearsals. So there's about a 10-minute sequence, which is the Jenny's first arrival, Alan asking for a glass of water. It's kind of those early things. And I was going to ask, it's a very specific question, was that filmed in the actual One Show studio? Do you remember?
Oh, did they put that on it? Yeah. Am I wearing like a grey dress? Is it a different outfit?
And the digi wall is just like a piece of cardboard at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. I think we did film that at the One Show Studios.
TV knowledge.
On a Sunday or something like that. Yeah,
it's all
pretty
curtained
sure
off behind
did.
You.
Yeah. Yes, we did. Yes, because I was in Alex Jones's dressing room.
There
That's
you go.
Also an exclusive.
But
I think I left it. I think I left it quite tidy. But yeah, that was really. I mean, obviously, that's also just super helpful, isn't it, to be in a studio like that and see what their, you know, what their clothes look like and what the setup is, and we needed to kind of do those sorts of rehearsals, I think, before the first outing.
Because I guess the reality is, for shows like The One Show in particular, the actual studio is tiny, and I think that would surprise quite a lot of people how confined those spaces are. And
yeah.
I guess one of the inherent jokes in this time is the studio is far too big.
Yes. Exactly.
I think
massive.
We counted like the amount of steps Alan has to take to the digiwall, and in each episode, I think it got one less or one more, but it was always like 15 steps, which in real TV would never happen.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they think of everything, don't they? The timing, the kind of awkward pauses where he's stopped talking before he then has another four steps before he gets to who he's supposed to be talking to. Just those kinds of little bits of detail, and the awkward pauses and bits where things are hanging in the air. Yeah, just brilliant.
Fantastic.
We've got a couple of listener questions that are coming from Twitter, fully vetted, don't worry. So first off, did Steve stay in character kind of whilst he was filming? Like, you know, did he take much of a kind of a method approach where he was Alan sort of during the day, and then when the kind of, you know, the wig comes off, it's Steve? Or is he kind of...
No, we were talking about our bathrooms between, no. An answer.
Fair enough.
I think it would be too much yeah. to stay in character with him.
That would drive you all mad, wouldn't it? Yeah,
me particularly, because I had to sit next to him for 14 hours a day. Steve is amazing at just kind of switching into it, and you get quite good at that.
Mm. I should say that question came in from Gary Lord. This is from Pete Millett, I think is a slightly more abstract question, but I do like it. If Alan Partridge was listed as a missing person, would Jenny assist with the public media campaign to help to find him, or would she politely decline?
That is so abstract. I love it. I think she would, because I think it would be useful publicity for herself, wouldn't it? I think she'd probably find an angle on it that would kind of aid her visibility, shall we say.
Absolutely. Well, look, we should probably wrap things up. So your new drama, Life, is on BBC right now. Is there anything else you want to tell us about in terms of, you know, what's coming up in the future? Anything else to mention at this point?
Well, it's been a slightly quiet few months. So the things that I was supposed to be shooting look like they will be shooting next year. And that's another comedy written by Rob and Neil Gibbons. And obviously this time too. So let's hope that
Fantastic.
Comes out sooner rather than later.
Indeed. Well, we just want to say a huge, great big thank you for joining us. We've really appreciated your time and your insight. So thank you so much. And I think the only thing I'd say before you go is it's intimate. Intimate.
Very good.
Intimate.
Teaser gets left. But it's lovely to meet you guys.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much
for your time.
Thank you. Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
So there we go. Some exciting teasers for this time series too, and all manner of other information about Jenny Gresham, Alan, and the APU in general. Huge thanks again to Susanna Fielding for her time. If you'd like to get in touch with us with questions for us, or perhaps for a future guest, or theories or concerns, maybe not concerns, about Monkey Tennis, or about From the Oast House, or about Alan Partridge, then we're on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, facebook.com/ThePartridgePod. You can email thepartridgepod@gmail.com. WhatsApp, you can leave us a voice note there on the Monkey Tennis hotline, 07923 600017, and perhaps feature in a future episode of Monkey Tennis. And if you'd like to chuck us the price of a cup of coffee to keep the show going and ensure there's more chat about Alan for years to come, you can head to ko-fi.com/monkeytennis and sling us a couple of quid there. We appreciate all of your donations and your feedback. We'll be back with more from the Oast House next week. But thank you very much for listening, and from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, thanks and goodbye.
This is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick. With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yep, absolutely. Yep, 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 absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk. Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the host house.
Keep it down, love.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.